Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 249, recorded Monday, May 9th, 2016. The real Dan Lyons. Triangulation is brought to you by PillPack, a full-service online pharmacy that combines modern technology, convenient packaging, and personalized service to make your life easier. Visit PillPack.com/TWIT to save $20 on vitamins and OTCs when you transfer your prescriptions. And by DigitalOcean, simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers. Deploy an SSD cloud server in 55 seconds. Try it today for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com. Once you sign up, make sure to enter the promo code TRIANGULATION in the billing section and get a $10 credit. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology. I just love this because I get to sit down and talk to some of my heroes, people I'm a huge fan of. And I've been trying to get this guy on the show, although apparently he doesn't know it. So there was a disconnect for a long, long time. You may remember Dan Lyons. I'm sure if I say the name, you're going to go, Dan Lyons, I know that name. Fake Steve Jobs. The Secret Diary of Steve Jobs. Dude, I invented the friggin' iPhone. Have you heard of it? That's Steve Jobs. He wrote for Newsweek for many years. Took a wrong turn a few years back. Got into marketing. We call it the dark side. But he got a book out of it, so it's okay now. And the book is out now. It just came out. It's called Disrupted. My Misadventures in the Startup Bubble. Dan Lyons, it's so great to have you on Triangulation.
Welcome. Oh, thank you for having me here. I am very excited to be. I wanted to be on this show for a long time. I just didn't know. There were a few years where the phone didn't ring, I got to tell you.
It wasn't me, because I am an old guy in tech journalism. It's not. The phone doesn't ring much.
I know what you mean. We're old?
Ish.
You think we're old?
Ish.
Ish. Old-ish.
Ish. Actually, that's kind of one of the premises of this is here's a guy in his 50s going to work at a startup. So I'm going to admit something to you. Yeah. So I never met you. I've always admired you from afar. And, of course, we have many friends in common. And I finally got to meet you. I did something I very rarely do, which is I agreed to go to a secret event at Google where Rich Osterloh and Motorola were showing off a new phone. We didn't know anything about it.
That's right.
And Guy Kawasaki called me and said, "This you can't tell anybody, but would you like to go to this?" And normally I say, no, I don't do that. But I did in this case. And I'm really glad I did because we were seeing the first Moto X. And there was Dan Lyons. And that was such a great honor. And we sat down. We got to talk a little bit. And I admire you so much. And you're just as funny and trenchant in person. And then we just kind of lost track of each other, and I really wanted to get you ever since. And then I heard you were writing for Silicon Valley, and I said, perfect.
Right.
Perfect.
So I can give you all sorts of dish and inside scoop.
Oh, I want to hear that, too. But how did you get started in tech writing?
I was working in daily newspapers back in New England, in Boston. And in fact, I was at the Herald when it was owned by Rupert Murdoch, when it was a tabloid.
God.
And I had a buddy that I went to high school with and then worked at a daily paper with. He went to a work at PC Week, which was in the Prudential Center in those days. And he called me up and he said, look, this place is really taking off. This computer thing is going to be huge. And why don't you come over here and work as a reporter? And I said, well, I don't know anything about computers or technology. He said, it's okay. Nobody does. And, you know, we were covering Wall Street. We were covering sort of the business side of the business. So it was – you didn't have to be too gorpy and techie, right? So, that's how I started. I was working at PC Week. I did that for a few years in Boston. And I loved it. I loved everything about the industry. And I ended up covering – hardware for a while, and then software, and different beats. Because you get moved around onto different things. It was covering Microsoft back in the early days of Microsoft before they had apps, when they just had DOS, really, and then they had Windows, and then Lotus in the early days. So it was great people. It was a really fun. It was a fun thing to cover as a journalist,
and Boston was a big
a hub at the time because of Route 128 and DEC and Data General. And I mean, it isn't so much anymore, but it was really big then. And of course, that's where Wang. Lotus was and Wang.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there was a real tech scene here, and there was, but it was, that was the sea change. Those years, I think, in the early 90s, it all started to change. And then when the internet happened, everything became San Francisco or the Bay Area. But yeah. It was really fun. Really, really. And the people who worked at PC Week in those days were just a really, really great bunch of people who a lot of them are still in and around the tech industry. So it was a really, really good time.
Yeah, I worked for Ziff Davis roughly that time frame as well.
Which publication?
I wasn't at a publication. In 92, I had started working with a guy named Halsey Miner and his partner Shelby Bonney. And they called me up and they said, we want to do a technology television network. And I was at the time doing a radio show with Dvorak, a national radio show with Dvorak about computers. And they said, you're one of the few guys who's actually doing this in mainstream media. We need you to pick your brain. So they came out. They hired me for 2 weeks. I worked for Halsey for 2 weeks. They hired me as the VP programming. I was the fourth employee. There was a woman, a marketing woman, then Halsey and Shelby. And but with Halsey, there was a weird thing because he was like Jobs. He would turn on you at some point for unknown reasons, and you'd just be out. And so all of a sudden, he stopped talking to me, and to find out months later that I no longer work for them. But he did at one point, and I regret this. He said, if you had $10,000... we would like to make you a partner in the CNET thing. And I said, you know, I just bought a house. I really don't. And in my back of my mind, I'm going, and you guys have not a shot in hell. Because I did the due diligence on a television network for technology. This was 90, 91. And I said, it's going to cost you $50 million a year for 10 years. It took CNN 10 years to go from in the red into the black. You need to have $500 million that you can spend before you start making money, and then you'll make it back. And that was enough to convince them to pivot, and they ended up doing a website, which turned out
instead.
Pretty well. Yeah.
So that started as a Ziff Davis thing then.
No.
I didn't realize.
No.
Oh, no.
Okay. I'm sorry. This is a long story, and you should be telling the stories, not me. So the way Halsey fired me 6 months later is he calls me in to show me their beautiful new offices in San Francisco. And he says, I don't have anything for you. But here's this press release from Ziff Davis. They're looking for someone. Maybe you should call them. That was his way of firing me. Maybe you should call them.
Yeah, I love it.
So I called them. And so I was working in their nascent television division. They didn't really have a television division. But we ended up doing the site for MSNBC in 96 and then ZDTV. And so because I was a broadcast journalist, I never was a – I'd written for Byton and Ford and stuff. But I didn't – writing's too much work. You guys work too hard. I just like talking. So –
But I remember ZDTV. I remember when that was a thing. Yeah.
We watched that. And,
Oh, neat. Yeah. And do you ever regret not getting a piece of CNET? What did they end up –
Oh, I would have been a billionaire or something, at least a hundred millionaire at this point.
Yeah, right?
Because he needed money and he hadn't raised capital. I don't know, though. You know, with Halsey and Shelby, it might well have been they took my money and, you know, gave me some C-class shares that evaporated with dilution. I don't know. You never know. Do you fantasize about that? Because we both are on the sidelines watching this all happen.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. No, when I was in 88 or 89 or so, I went to Microsoft with another reporter from PC Week, and we spent a few days there. We met everybody, Bill Gates and Ballmer and all these guys, and they told us this great story, a whole bunch of stories. And we went back and wrote a whole package of stories for PC Week, a whole cover package. And she turned around, my colleague, and flew right back to Redmond and got some kind of a job in marketing or something, right? And I remember thinking, wow, that's pretty risky. And in less than 10 years, she was retired.
Yeah.
Done, you know? She got it just as it was taking off. And I've often thought, boy, yeah. I mean, it's hard not to, right? I mean, you're covering people who have these things with lightning strikes and their life changes. It's pretty amazing.
Was that some of the motivation to go to HubSpot? Here's a startup. Maybe I could still get in on this.
Yeah, I mean, I knew they were too late stage, and I was coming in way too late to really get enough where, you know, $10,000 becomes $100 million, right? Like, I didn't have any illusions about that. But I thought, A, this, I got laid off at Newsweek. There are no other jobs really in media. I mean, there are some, but it wasn't just that Newsweek was kind of going out of business, but that everybody was kind of going out of business. So I thought, I'd always fantasized about this. I thought, well, what better time than now to try to make this jump? I didn't think HubSpot would make me rich, but I thought, I'll do this for 4 years. I'll get, you know, I had a nice chunk of options that if the stock did well, I would have a nice little nut of money. And if it turned into Google, you know, obviously I'd be really well off, but I didn't expect that. But I really was thinking, I'll do this for 3 or 4 years, and then while I'm doing that, I'll be looking around for spin out companies and try to get into some new company when it's really early stage, but with a bigger role. So that was definitely in my mind.
But you were going over to the dark side. I mean, so this is the confession. Yeah. I'm meeting you at Google. I'm thinking, I couldn't understand what HubSpot did, and then I couldn't understand why they would hire a journalist.
Yeah.
I didn't get it. Well, I don't know. I think I got the sense you didn't really get what you were doing there either.
Yeah, that's totally true. Well, you know, I was there at that Google thing. There were two people from HubSpot there. They had someone else who does what they call influencer relations, and she got a separate invitation from Guy Kawasaki. Guy worked us separately.
Good at
and
that.
I didn't know she was going, and she didn't know as I was going.
Wow.
And I showed up, and there she is. And I'm like, wait a minute, what are you doing here? And she's, you know, yeah, it was that kind of place. HubSpot was a little chaotic, not a lot of organization. But in theory, I was hired, you know, the way a lot of companies now are hiring journalists, a lot of VC firms
right.
are hiring journalists to come in and
right.
sort of be their content creator or run a content team or whatever they want to call it. But basically promote the brand, right? So I thought that's what I was getting hired to do. And I thought, you know, that's not too different than being a journalist, at least, you know, in terms of what you do every day. I'll still write articles. I'll be editing. I'll be trying to shape sort of what a publication should look like. So I thought that would make it an easier transition. But yeah, I was not under any illusions that it was not the dark side. Although, you know, there's also this whole field of content marketing and brand journalism or corporate journalism. They call it different things. But there's a guy at IBM who used to be at Business Week named Steve Hamm. There's a guy at GE named Tomas Kellner who I worked with at Forbes. So who are doing really, really good stuff. And at Qualcomm at the time had a really good publication. Microsoft still has this thing called Microsoft Stories. So I thought, well, okay, if the media business is blowing up, I got to do something. And maybe the media business is moving into corporations, into sort of inside companies, and you can do some... It's never going to be as much fun as working at Forbes or Newsweek. Like, okay, I get that. But it'll be something. It'll be sort of something I can do, and I might be good at it. And it'll be a field that seems to be growing. So, yeah, it felt to me like something worth trying. You know, that's I'd put it that way.
Yeah. And you got a book out of it.
I got a book out of it, although not the book I would have expected. I kind of thought I was going to end up writing a book about brand journalism and corporate marketing, and here's how to do it. And like, I kind of thought either after 3 or 4 years of doing this, I'll either find a new job at a startup or I can kind of establish myself as like the guy who'll come into your company and do best practices with you when you want to build a newsroom. So like Oracle
right.
has a newsroom, Intel
right.
has a newsroom, all these companies. So I thought, and a couple of people I know also felt the same way, that you could have a consulting business around helping companies become or build little mini news operations. So that's the kind of book I kind of thought I would end up writing after putting in time in there. And I thought, I need some credibility. You can't just go straight from Newsweek into that. You need to have spent some time in the corporate world to have some sort of credibility. Anyway, I maybe still could do that, but I'm not sure if I've become a little disillusioned with corporate journalism. So I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Actually, after we met, and I started seeing so many people doing this. I mean, that's what Scobel did for Rackspace. It's not
right.
an unusual thing. And I realized this is what's happening. And frankly, if you're a print journalist, you got to find something, because print journalism isn't exactly vital these days, unfortunately.
No. In fact, I just got, I was talking to someone about doing a, was a guy I worked with at Newsweek, and he's doing some stuff for, I don't want to say who, but about, but a big, you know, corporate kind of gig. And then he said to me, you know, we got a new editor, and it's this guy who I also, I've never met him, but I know we have a lot of mutual friends, but a guy who was pretty high up at the Wall Street Journal. It's like, wow, we're all landing, you know, somewhere in some kind of corporate thing. I mean, it's sort of, there's this big migration of journalists into sort of quasi-journalistic or journalistic-related fields,
I
guess
you'd
call
it. Do you think that's a bad trend?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not bad in the sense that I blame anybody doing it.
You got to make a living.
You got to feed our kids.
Yeah.
But I think it's a bad trend to have less and less journalism, you know, fewer and fewer publications. Did you see that there was a quote or an interview with the guy who was Obama's foreign policy advisor over the weekend, or maybe late last week, was ranting about how he basically said, here's how we would get stories out. Like when we wanted to sell the Iran deal, we have friends in publications, here's in mouthpieces that we use, blah, blah, blah. But there's one rant where he says, and I don't have it in front of me for a direct quote, but he basically says, we're dealing now, reporters used to have magazines and publications, newspapers had bureaus all around the world. So when something happened in the Middle East, they had their own reporter in the Middle East who actually understood what's going on in the Middle East. He said, now everybody's covering everything out of D.C., and I'm dealing with 27-year-old reporters who don't know anything because they don't have any experience. All their experience is that they covered a campaign, and now they got thrown into, like, well, write about the White House. And
you're talking about Rhodes.
Yeah.
He's a novelist.
Yes.
And he became...
Oh, but, you know about this thing.
Yeah, right? This was in the Times. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, look, he pulled it right up. Yeah. So, and that to me is like, that's the essence of it. And it's the same in tech, right? I mean, you used to have the San Jose Mercury News doing, you know, kind of good coverage of Silicon Valley. You had the San Francisco Chronicle doing stuff. You had the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. And I think it's bad for all of us to have fewer outlets covering things objectively, and you know, the idea of, and the mainstream media now is so driven by the internet, it's about chasing clicks, and that also has a negative effect.
Absolutely.
But yeah, no, I think it's a shame. It is definitely unfortunate.
And I don't know what to do with it. I mean, the thing that's interesting is that we all hailed the internet in the late 90s and there as a democratizing, everybody's going to get a voice. It's going to be the rebirth of journalism. Andrew Sullivan wrote a great piece on this in the New York Magazine a couple of days ago that I thought was about Trump, but it was also about how the failed promise of the internet, that in fact all of this democratizing and giving everybody a voice. And I hate to say, oh, Andrew Keen was right, because I don't know if he was another friend. He's, of course, the guy who wrote The Cult of the Amateur, and he can't, you know, his position was as an elitist, saying you don't want all these amateurs doing this stuff. But there was something to be said, and maybe I'm just getting old, but there was something to be said for a time when there was a cultural elite, and there was, I don't know, that sounds very elitist.
I know, right? I have the same, and I know the Andrew Sullivan essay you're talking about was the rise of, America's never been more ripe for tyranny,
yes,
right? It was a really good essay, and it was talking about, well, see, I think if you had the mainstream media or the elites as we always had it, and then everything else was additive, and then everybody else also had a voice, that would be great. But what we've had instead is that everybody else has a voice, but then the mainstream publications just don't have a business model, and they don't have, there's nothing to hold them up, and that's... So those guys have faded, and I don't blame I like reading blogs, and I like seeing that everybody has a voice and anybody can have a publication, and if you have interesting things to say, you can find an audience. But oh, there it is. Yeah. But you're right. I think the decline of serious journalism is a real problem. And look at, you know, another thing I've noticed this year in the primary season is that I've been kind of following the Hillary versus Bernie race, and you'll see these articles pop up on Facebook. So this is the other thing. So now the filter is Facebook, right? That's where you're finding a lot of my news.
Right.
So there's an article on Facebook, and someone says, this is a really good article about how corrupt Bernie Sanders is.
I saw that. Bernie. And I read it. And then you find out who wrote it.
Like, it was like Joe Connison or something, or one of these Hillary hacks who has started a blog. But and they started them like a year ago. So they have a history of, it's not brand new, but it's, you realize these are blogs that were set up by Hillary, right? And her camp.
It's propaganda.
It's propaganda, but it looks like news, right? And Bernie has his little list of these blogs. So it also, these aren't, so it isn't just grassroots, like everybody can publish. These are basically a new form of media that masquerades as real media. But yeah, it's, and I was wondering, most people reading those articles aren't doing that analysis, or don't, the name Joe Connison doesn't ring a bell to them, right? Because he's kind of, who knows Joe Connison, right? And so you take it as true, as fact, or as real journalism. And yeah, so it's, if nothing else, it muddies the water, right? It muddies the water enough to say, well, I don't know, maybe Bernie isn't all that, because I read this thing and I don't remember where I read it, but somebody said he did X,
exactly.
Y, and Z.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's, you know, yeah, it's ugly stuff.
Well, it's not, propaganda is not new. It goes back at least a century. I think the internet has given us such, given these people such great tools that it's very hard now to know what you're reading. And I worry, because I feel like it's bad in our business, in the tech journalism business, but it's even worse when it comes to, you know, real serious stuff. I didn't mean to get heavy on you, because this guy is one of the funniest guys in the business. He is a great satirist, and I want to talk a little bit about the fake Steve Jobs blog. You can go back to the original archives now, by the way, if you go to his site. You go back to 2006, and this back when you were using Blogspot.
That's right, yeah.
Oh, look at this, like Loyalty.
This is from Matters.
Loyalty Matters, 2007. So this is Steve Jobs' voice. And by the way, you channeled Steve beautifully. You're a master satirist. I really think this is where you excel. So Al Gore calls me. I love the writing style too. So Al Gore calls me. He's heard about the meeting with the Clintstones, and he says he knows all the crap that Hillary was saying about him, and he just sighs and he goes in this really sad voice, "Well, Steve, it's been great being on your board. I mean it, and I really thank you for giving me the opportunity and for the free power books and everything. Seriously, you're a great guy. Seriously." And I'm like, "Al, what are you talking about?" He goes, "Well, all that stuff." Anyway, it goes on. You cannot read this.
That's
without
a good Al Gore impersonation.
I know. Thank you. It's actually, because you got the voice. Do you? This is Steve Jobs' voice. Do you read these out loud when you were writing them? Did you say them out loud?
I think sometimes I used to, or I would work it out in my head out loud before I wrote it. You know,
it's very verbal.
I used to walk around a lot in those days. It's really sad, but I would walk around a lot, sort of thinking of Steve Jobs' monologues I was almost relieved to not do it anymore, because it was like, got a little crazy for a while. But a day never went by that I didn't think about, well, what's Steve thinking about today? And
you're channeling him, and I think there is this kind of creepy thing that can happen where you start to, the boundaries start to dissolve.
But I have no idea what he really talked like. I mean, I saw him on stage. I never met him,
right?
And I never, I didn't know that he swore a lot until I read the Isaacson biography, where you realize like he was, you talked to people who knew him, but he was, and mind you, I don't think he liked the blog very much, but he put up with it. I think sometimes maybe I was saying what he would have liked to say, but, times no, you know, like, I don't think Katie Cotton, the PR woman, liked
sure
the blog.
She hated it. Yeah.
Did she?
Oh, I don't know, but I'm sure she... I mean, that's her job, right, is to defend Steve.
Yeah, I would depict her as like a prison guard with a rifle up on a turret and stuff, and she was, you know, she... But I've got to be friendly with other Apple PR people, and I think they were okay, you know, but... I mean, I think he was difficult, right? But, I mean, he was... Of course he was difficult. That's...
Now you stopped writing it because he got sick and for a long time nobody knew it was you. You were anonymous.
Yeah, I was, and I realized. I mean, there were a lot of people who knew that I was doing it, right?
Oh, so there were. Okay.
Yeah, well, yeah, there wasn't a very well kept secret, but they all kind of kept it quiet. But I knew it would come out, right? Because it was just too many people knew, and but I kind of figured that the mystery thing would make it more fun. Like people would like the, it would add to the allure. If no one knows who's doing it, that'll make it a little more mysterious. And then, you know, Gawker kept trying to figure out who it was. And twice they announced they had figured it out. And both times they were wrong, which I loved. And I was able to make fun of them.
You must
and,
have some sympathy for Satoshi Nakamoto these days.
Yeah, that poor guy. You mean the real guy?
The real
right?
guy.
Like, can you imagine? Like Newsweek knocks on his door and says, "We know it's you." And he's like, "What? What? I don't know." And like, and now apparently there is a real guy who.
No,
came out
this real guy turns out not to be the real guy. He's a con man who was making money pretending he was the real guy.
The Australian guy
yeah,
is a con man?
He's a con man.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I don't know if it's clear that, you know, because The Economist and the BBC haven't exactly retracted their stories, but yes.
Oh. No, I thought he was the real guy.
No, he's not the real guy. So that's what I'm saying is Satoshi's sitting there going, damn it, why do these people... And he, but he can't reveal himself. Now, did you feel like you couldn't reveal yourself?
Yeah, yeah. I figured I would have felt weird. Well, I was in the middle of doing a deal with Forbes when I got caught by the New York Times, and I don't know if we would have, if we were going to say that it was me. I can't remember now. I think maybe we were. We were going to do a big reveal and say, "Fake Steve Jobs is now going to be on the Forbes website, and it's being written by one of our guys." Blah blah blah.
That's
right?
No good. Yeah, but, I don't like that.
Yeah, maybe I don't know if we were going to do the reveal or not, but then. Anyway, Brad Stone at the New York Times figured it out. But
it's like Joe Klein, because he wrote Primary Colors as anonymous. And that gave him, and I bet it gave you too, this amazing freedom to tell the truth in your own satirical way.
Yes, but sometimes it also gives you this license. Sometimes you say things that maybe you wouldn't say to someone to their face.
Oh, I don't know anything about that. You mean chat room handles, things like that, and anonymity on the internet? I wouldn't know anything about the license that gives you.
Yeah.
Did you feel guilty?
Yeah. Yeah.
You felt
I still
bad?
Do.
Really?
Yeah. Sometimes, yeah. And then I find it, yeah.
Can I
and,
let you off the hook?
Sure, yeah.
Don't feel bad.
Oh, really?
The stuff you did was literally brilliant. The word is not, is overused. Brilliant. This is really brilliant stuff. Don't feel bad. You did something great. This is so Al Gore calls and he's like, yeah, Steve, I know. I've been So Bill Gates calls and he's laughing in that nasal voice of his. He goes, "Hey, Steve, bummer, all this. This is the funniest stuff ever."
Tom Mesereau calls. This was about the options backdating, I think.
Oh, my God.
And isn't Mesereau a lawyer or something?
Yeah. So there's a truth.
I would sometimes do the string of phone calls, like so and so.
Right.
Calls,
so Lou Gerstner calls. So Mel Gibson calls. He says, "Hey, man, I'm sitting here in rehab, feeling sorry for myself. Sorry for myself. And I saw what they're doing to you, and I'm like, you know what? I'm a lucky man. Believe me."
Yeah. Mel Gibson feels bad for you. Yeah. And then I had one where it was like, what was it? God, it was really good. It was, sorry.
So Michael Moore calls. He says, "Look, Steve, I'm standing outside your building with a film crew, and your dickhead security goons won't let me in." "Yeah, you, buddy. I just called you a dickhead, so deal with it." Not you, Steve. Sorry.
Yeah,
Michael
Moore.
So this is, and I'm glad it's still online. Thank God. One thing about the internet, nothing dies.
And the good thing about those is those things would be written, like they would be coming out live. Like I literally would think of it. Write it, post it, and everybody would be reading it. And then they'd like be waiting now. You know there's another one coming, right? So people would stay on the site or they'd dial back in to see like, okay, who's the next call going to come from? And I honestly wouldn't know myself. I would just be sitting there like laughing my butt off, right? Just thinking of, oh, I had one where Bin Laden calls in and Bin Laden says, "Why didn't I think of this?" You know what it was? It was I did Operation Chokehold where they were going to – I told everybody to get on their phones, their iPhones at noon Pacific on a Friday to take down the AT&T network. And because we were pissed at AT&T for threatening to throttle back people's data plans. So I said, all right, we're going to – the Apple engineers have come up with this idea, Operation Chokehold. We think if everybody goes on at the same time on AT&T and puts on like a video on YouTube, it'll crash the network, right? And then people took it seriously. Next thing you know, I was on Wolf Blitzer. Wolf Blitzer is talking about, they're calling it Operation Chokehold. It's started on a chokehold. I was like, oh my God. And I was working at Newsweek at the time and I thought, I'm definitely going to get fired for this, right? And at one point, yeah, so Operation Chokehold was like, so Wolf Blitzer. Then I had Al Gore calling saying, He's worried that Operation Chokehold could raise ocean levels by a half a foot in the next 6 years. And then it was all these different people call in saying about, oh, the United Nations had a fake meeting. And then there was one where Bin Laden calls and says, why didn't I think of this? This is great, you know. Anyway, it was, yeah, I used to, God, sometimes it was so much fun doing that.
I bet it was fun. It was fun to read. And we all read
it. After he died, I had this idea, not right away, but I thought if you waited enough time, it's too late now, though, that he's blogging from the afterlife.
Oh,
like he's still there.
Oh, wow.
And he's pissed at Tim Cook for screwing everything up.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
He's like, no, not the watch. Not the watch. No, no, no. Don't do the watch. No one wants the watch. And
that would be great.
Right. It could be. And then I even thought it would be a good TV show where, because, you know, I developed a TV show based on Fake Steve called Icon, which we sold to the Epix cable network and developed it and wrote a bunch of scripts.
That was
and
Sony,
never,
right? Yeah.
Oh, well, Epix. Yeah. Epix is owned by three companies or whatever.
Oh, okay.
But they never ended up making any shows, I don't think. Oh, and they made comedy shows. I mean, they never made any scripted entertainment.
Right.
But and then once it got dropped there, we never could revive it anywhere. But then I had this idea. What if you had a show about a CEO who gets, you know, hit by a bus, and he more like a young CEO? Imagine like Travis Kalanick,
right?
Or something like
that.
Someone
Uber.
Kind of obnoxious, kind of, you know, just a combative kind of guy, and gets taken too soon in some, you know, ridiculous way, and then has to watch as his heir, his successor, just screws up the company, and you know, so half the show is set in the afterlife where he's meeting famous dead people. You know, and some of them aren't. So, like, Gandhi's a dick. Like, Gandhi turns out to be an And then, you know, and then and then he can appear to Tim Cook, maybe. Like, he can just, like, you know, materialize sometimes. I had this idea. Nobody – I pitched to one guy in Hollywood. He just looked at me like, you're out of your mind. Like, just go away. So all of my ideas are like that. They're all terrible. They're all my show ideas, my TV show ideas.
I think the chat room's going crazy for the – the afterlife Steve Jobs, but
they are.
Oh yeah, they love it.
Really?
Yeah, they're saying.
I mentioned it.
Somebody said,
oh.
"Cook,
Cook,
get off your exercise bike, Tim."
I mean, yeah, I thought, you know, because then people would say to me, "Why don't you do fake Tim Cook?" And I was like, "Because he's already so boring. Like, could you imagine how boring?" Although you could do a funny like. A fake Tim Cook like Twitter feed where every day it would just be gets up and says one boring thing, right? And then that's it for the day.
That would be fun too. Yeah.
So
Twitter has kind of ruined this whole parody thing, I'm sorry to say.
Because now there's a million of them.
Yeah, and it's too easy. It's like one line, bored Elon Musk. It's good, but it's like it's not you can't you don't develop an idea so much. You did. You really would develop it. We're talking
bored Elon Musk was a good one, yeah.
It's good. It's still good. Yeah. We're talking to Dan Lyons. He is great. He's one of the funniest guys in tech reporting. He's also one of the most astute observers. But the great thing is he uses satire, he uses wit to tell the truth. And that's what the best humor does. His new book, Disrupted, talks about his life at the startup HubSpot. We'll talk about that and of course, Silicon Valley. You know, I'm thinking as we're talking about how the Internet has kind of democratized and at the same time brought the quality of discourse down. And I think of Mike Judge's movie, Idiocracy. We're kind of headed for that in some respects, but anyway.
And here we are, you and I, keeping the discourse at a high level.
Thank God. Thank God.
Somebody has to have standards, Leo. Somebody has to do it, and it's us.
It's us. I've decided.
We're keeping it alive. So, you know, Idiocracy, I watched that before I went to work on the season two of Silicon Valley. I watched everything I could of Mike Judge's work, and I thought, how come I've never seen this movie before?
Because
It is genius. Like
and
it is
true.
It is today, right?
I mean, yes.
The president is a former world wrestling, a WWE pro wrestler, right? I mean, actually a guy from Gawker. I guess this is not Tales Out of School. Somebody from Gawker wrote to me a few months ago wanting an intro to Mike Judge because I think it's the 10th anniversary of that movie and they want to do a big festival or a day, some kind of thing around it where they show the movie and Mike Judge talks and they... because in their point, like it is now not even fiction anymore. Like it was prescient, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's a great idea. I think, yeah, and yeah, you realize what Mike Judge is doing is trying to show you the world you live in.
Right.
And I think that's what he wanted to do with Silicon Valley too, and what he does do. And I think he's really interested in satire. I think he's just a guy who looks at the world and sees it in a way the rest of us don't. But it's true. You know what I mean? But he's a very interesting guy with an amazing perspective on the world.
I want to talk more about that and more about Dan and his book and his website, Real Dan Lyons. He's the Real Dan Lyons, and he's with us right now in Triangulation. But first, a word from our sponsors. PillPack. Have you, everybody nowadays is you have a pharmacist. I hope you do, and if you don't, you will. And maybe you go for vitamins or an occasional sleeping draft, as they used to call it, or perhaps, like me, that there's some daily medications you need to take. I got a better way to do it. I'm so glad that I found PillPack. The idea of PillPack, first of all, it's online. That has a bad connotation, I think. It's a real pharmacy. It's really a real pharmacy with real pharmacists you could talk to. And by the way, I love this, 24/7 in the privacy of your own home. You call them on the phone and they will talk to you. They'll talk about your medications and so forth. But then one of the best things, that's good, is they also deliver your medications via the mail in a pill pack. And this is really cool. Now, of course, if it's an ointment or cream, an inhaler, diabetic supplies, they'll come in the refrigerated pill pack box. But this is the pill pack for the pills. And it's so cool. These are packed with image recognition machines. And then, of course, a pharmacist reviews every single pill pack. You'll see on the back your name, the date, a picture of the medication or the vitamin you're taking, a description, the prescription information, the dosing directions. And then each day you will pull off a pack. They're very easy to open. I don't know why I'm still getting childproof medication. There's no kids in my house. It tells you the date, the day, the time, what's in it. If you're traveling, this is so great. You just tear off the packs you're going to need. You throw them in your suitcase. It couldn't be easier. You never have to say, well, did I take my melatonin this evening? Yes, you did, because it's gone. Or, oh, no, I didn't. Here it is. It is fantastic. They handle refills for you. They'll automatically work with your doctor, so you proactively get the refills ahead of time. This is a fantastic way. A full-service online pharmacy that will wonder why you ever went to the drugstore. You'll never have to wait around for your prescriptions. You'll never have to get one of those pill minders and sort the pills out or chase your doctor down for refills. The pharmacists at PillPack.com take care of it for you. Go to PillPack.com/twit, and you can sign up now. It will take a few minutes. They'll check, make sure your insurance handles it. And most insurance does, including most types of Medicare Part D. And by the way, there's no cost to this. There's no shipping fee or anything. Just the normal copay. That's it. The service is basically free. And when you use the link at pillpack.com/twit and transfer your prescriptions over, we're going to give you $20 worth of vitamins and OTCs as a thank you. Make sure that you use PillPack, PILLPACK.com/twit. It's the best way to do this. Our guest is Dan Lyons, a strong man who can pull his own Ford truck, apparently. Strangest image on the front page of his website.
Yeah, I got to change that.
No, I love it.
You do?
Yeah.
I'm thinking maybe a new cover.
It's a little Freudian, Dan. It says a little bit about you.
A redesign might be in order. I think my website is still a little old, a little out of date, I think, frankly.
I think you're fantastic. I loved the book. And I should give some excerpts out of the book. There's a great thing that you talk about, Mark Andreessen. Oh, where is it?
Oh no, don't go there. Don't go
really?
There. Yes, okay. He doesn't know about it yet.
If you love Dan's sense of humor, you will love this. But it's also a memoir. I mean, you say that 4 months in, you realized you made by August. 4 months into my tenure at HubSpot, I'm ready to give up. I'm stuck in the content factory writing articles for imbeciles.
Oh, wow. Strong word.
I cannot do this for a living. But the story really is about bro culture, isn't it? I mean, that's what Silicon Valley has become. And I think that this needs to be a little bit punctured, the bro culture. HubSpot was not happy about you writing this book. Did they terminate you? What happened?
They, no. Well, yes and no.
They kind of pushed you out.
Yeah, I got in one of those situations where I had never been in the situation before, but I guess it happens in corporate life where they want you to leave, but for whatever reason, they're not going to fire you, so they just try to make you really unhappy so you'll
so
leave.
Horrible.
Which is like a weird thing. They want to just say, we'd like it if you leave, you know, or fire you, you know, but I guess maybe they don't want to do that. Or maybe because of my age, it made it hard to fire me. Or so, I don't know. So, yeah, it was a very unhappy time, and I was looking for another job, and I finally found something, and I said, okay, I gave my notice. And I gave them a lot of notice. It was like the week before Thanksgiving. So I said, well, look, I'm going to start this new job January 1st. So I'll and I was trying to get this podcast off the ground for them. And I said, well, I'll stay and I'll do the handoff. You know, after Thanksgiving, it'll be a few weeks. I'll do the handoff, and then it'll be Christmas, and basically I'll just be gone, and I'll start a new job in January. And they said, okay, great. And then I came in the next day, and they said, oh, here's your paper. You're today's your last day. Bye. Get out. And your pay ends today. And I was like, well, yeah, I just gave you notice. And so did they fire me? Did I quit? It's sort of like a little, I quit, and then they fired me.
Did they give you a graduation party anyway?
They did not call it graduation. Thank God. I was the only person I know who basically, when they left, they didn't call it graduation. And because that was the thing, one of the things they do, which I found really weird, was when they fired people or someone quit, either way, they called it graduation. And I think they thought that was really nice or hip or progressive, that this was like this cool thing that we call it. We don't call it firing people. We call it graduation. And we'd get this like cheery email saying, hey, guys, you know, just want you to know that Derek has graduated and we're so excited to see what he's going to do with his superpowers and his next big rock star adventure. And, you know, they really talk about people having superpowers and being rock stars and stuff. And I was like, you know, anyway.
That's a cult. That's what they say when, you know,
yeah,
everybody drinks the Kool-Aid and dies in their tracksuits and sneakers. Oh, we've all graduated to the next thing.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, one time they sent a whole, like 40 people to Dreamforce, the Salesforce.com conference, dressed in matching orange cheerleader tracksuits with pom-poms and like giving out little unicorns and running around like being really super peppy. And I was like, and it was the year before I joined. I was like, thank God, because faced with that choice, like I would not put on the orange tracksuit. But then I think if you didn't wear the tracksuit, I don't know what would happen to you, but I think you might get fired, right? I didn't want to find out. Because all I can imagine is like okay, I'm pretty desperate. I need a job. I don't think there's any situation in which I would put on the orange tracksuit. But all I can imagine, what if I did, and then I run into someone I know. You know what I mean?
How
someone
humiliating.
I know. Right. Like, what's happened to you? You're wearing an orange tracksuit running around this trade show. I was like, I know, dude. I'm sorry. It's just, you know, I don't want to talk about it. I mean, but they've now said they're not going to call it graduation anymore. They realize that that term is a little bit crazy, and they're going to do away with that.
Do you think the book influenced how HubSpot does its business?
Well, it's made them talk about wanting to be more diverse. I don't think anything will really change. I mean, mind you, I mean, the thing where the sort of elephant in the room is that when they found out I was writing a book, apparently they tried to hack my computers, and according to the FBI, they engaged in some kind of extortion attempt to try to prevent the book from being published. They did a lot of really scary, ugly stuff that I wasn't aware of until they announced one day that they had caught the people doing it, and that one guy had been fired, another had quit before he could get fired, the CEO was sanctioned, and went all the way to the top. And then I was interviewed by the FBI as a witness in this, you know, in this investigation. And then no charges were brought. But
must have, when you read that press release, come on, you cheered. That's the best thing that could happen to this book.
How cynical do you think I am?
Very.
Yeah.
No, it's not cynical. Leo. It's realist.
No, I did think, okay, yes. I actually say this in the book. Like, at first I thought, this is hilarious. Like, this is so funny. Like, they are such idiots. Like, I had been almost feeling guilty for writing this book and depicting them as such imbeciles. And then they did this, and I'm like, oh my God, you're even stupider than I thought, right? Because it is the worst possible. It's like, it's the Rupert Pupkin crime of the century, right?
Yeah. Kidnapping Jerry Lewis.
The publisher. Yeah. And we're going to kidnap Jerry Lewis, tape him to a chair, put a gun in his head. But it was like, but then I thought, wait a minute, what did they do? And they still won't tell me. And it actually ended up becoming scary. Now, like, you know what I mean? Like, did they hack into my house? Did they break into my house? You know, did they hire someone? And did that person take all of my family photos? Or do they have my bank account information? It actually started to get a little scary, and I'm still sort of in that place where I've never really been able to find out what happened. I've done a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI, and I got some documents from the FBI. But
So you still don't know how they hacked you or how they tried to steal it.
Right. Yeah. I don't know what they did. And but when I got the FBI documents, all they had talked about was we fired a guy for trying to get a hold of this book. And then I was interviewed by Cybercrime's people, so I thought, okay, it must be hacking.
Right.
However, when I got the FBI documents months and months later, it said, no, there was an extortion conspiracy to, like, dig up information about someone or someones and blackmail them so that they wouldn't publish the book. And this is a long way of answering your first question, which is, do I think this is going to have any change on them? No, because I think these are people who are capable of doing that kind of stuff. I don't think they're going to, like, change their – I think they'll make a lot of noise about trying to be better and do this and that, and we're radically transparent. But no, I mean, I think even – look, I know people on the board of this company, right? I know board members. One of them lives in my town. The CFO lives in my town, right? Our kids know each other. Our wives know each other, right? And they won't tell me what's going on because they're, I guess, trying to protect the stock price. I mean, so no, I don't imagine much – change is going to come out of this. I think these are, and that's the biggest revelation. And it only came to me after I had finished the book is these guys were scarier than, I mean, I wrote a book about, you know, silly bro culture and, you know, beer drinking and, you know, hookups in the bathrooms and stuff like that. And tried to make a bigger point about the racket that or the rigged game that I think Silicon Valley has become.
That's to me, it's not about HubSpot at all.
Right.
Who cares?
It isn't really about them. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't care about HubSpot, but I think
you've probably never heard of them, right? Before you read the book, had you ever even heard of them?
You're the only person I ever heard about them from because you told me you were working for HubSpot. And at the time, I said, well, who are they? What are they? And I don't think anybody really knew. It was a company that before they, you say this in the book, you said, most companies would start with an invention, an innovation, a technology. They started by hiring a marketing guy.
And a sales guy.
They didn't have a product. Yeah. They just hired a sales guy. And by the way, season 3 of Silicon Valley, which I know you're one of the writers, our co-producer even, that's exactly what happens is the new CEO comes in, the salespeople start running the company, and it's no longer about innovation. And I think really that's what's most interesting about this book. It's a commentary on a culture that is weirdly broken.
Yeah, I find that kind of amazing. And in the course of writing the book, I interviewed a lot of people, but all of them off the record, but just very either CEOs or venture capitalists or investment bankers, people around the business. And this story started to take shape that this is one great anecdote I love is a VC who's actually a very good friend of mine, and I really respect him. But he basically said to me, look, here's how it works. It's like making a movie, right? So we, the VCs, we're the movie producers, right? So we have a bunch of money, and we go out and we find a leading man. We want him to look like Mark Zuckerberg, right? We want him to be young, a little bit awkward. And then we write a script. We tell a story, and that's our corporate narrative. And it has to have, you know, a eureka moment, and it has to have a journey into the underground, a hero's journey, right. And it has to have a triumph and obstacles. It has to have drama, and then we have to have this story about disrupting a big $1 trillion market. And we take that story, and once we start getting a little traction with it, we just pump millions of dollars either into customer acquisition or into audience acquisition, right? Yeah. So if we're selling something that for money, we need to go out and acquire customers, and we can lose money doing it. Or if it's eyeballs, we just go out and acquire eyeballs. And you can do that, and we want to show a top line revenue growth because the story the public markets want right now is just this company's growing like crazy. They're going to be huge. They're worth billions. Buy the stock. Don't look at the bottom line because they're losing money, but that doesn't matter because someday they're going to make money just like Facebook did. And he said, and then we build enough hype. We put asses in the seats. I want those people lined up around the block on Friday night for opening night. That's our IPO. Boom, we IPO and we all make money. And I was like, wow, that is like phenomenal to have a VC tell you this is the business we're in, right? We're telling a story.
It feels deeply cynical.
Yeah. 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 Right? I mean, it's amazingly cynical. And the guy who's telling me this is a VC who does this for a living, but who also studied, I don't know if he studied filmmaking in college, but he definitely knows a lot about, has a lot of friends in Hollywood. And I think he sort of dabbled in that business as an undergrad. So he's sort of interested in how stories and movies get made. And it was this analogy that blew me away. I was at HubSpot when he told me this story. It was just like, here's how it works.
I want to extend the analogy, because in the film industry, there are still artists who don't work that way, who come from the story first and the art first, and they want to create a work of art. And occasionally, one in 100 films is made that way. And I think in Silicon Valley, this is also true. And this is what gets me, is that there are still people creating technologies that will change the world, that are significant, that are important. And all of the noise going around from the cynical, basically manipulation of the market, it's about making money, obscures these real creations. And so I would say that our mission, yours and mine and anybody who cares about the world and technology, is to find those guys and to raise them up and to stop writing stories about Theranos.
Right. And Theranos is one example. And here's the thing. Like, I believe, and you probably do too, I'm sure you do, that, you know, we are now living in an incredibly exciting time.
Yes.
Right? We're on the verge of AI becoming a reality and becoming widespread and changing our lives, right? And robotics and genomics and biotech I don't think I'm going to live to see this, right? But I think, like, my kids, I have 10-year-old twins.
Yeah.
I always tell them, like, you are going to live in the most exciting century of all time. Like, so much. I mean, the human species itself is going to change in the next 100 years, potentially, right? Energy breakthroughs, climate change. I mean, this fantastic stuff happening. You're right. And that was always, to me, the fun about covering tech was you're writing about the people doing this. I can't do it because I'm not an engineer and I don't have that. I don't know how to do any of those things. So the next best thing for me is to be the guy writing about it, right?
We have ringside seats at the revolution.
Exactly. And that's, like, so amazing, like, so cool. And then you have all this other noise and fluff. And maybe it's wrong. You know, I actually could buy into the argument that says me writing this book about all the stuff that isn't that is just sort of drawing attention to the BS. And why even bother doing that? Like, why write about that? I mean, I originally wanted to write it because I thought it was funny. And then later started to think there's actually more than just something funny to it. There's something important there. But it doesn't, you're right. It shouldn't take away or diminish from the great stuff. For example, I think Google X, I don't know what goes on inside there, but if I could find out and you know, write about it in some way or promote it, I think those people are heroes. Andy Rubin, who created Android, to me still remains like an amazing hero. I'm so fascinated by Android since the first time I saw it, thought, like, this is going to change the world. And I think it really has. I mean, it's put, you know, computing power, it's put real, you know, this thing, right, into the hands of people all around the world who never had a computer before. That, to me, is amazing stuff, right? And I think that's kind of the more important role, is to hold up the heroes and tell their stories. I mean, the whole race for AI right now is one that fascinates me. I would love to write a book about that, about who's doing it, you know, or, you know, brain builders, people who are trying to reverse engineer the human brain in various ways in silicon, which is so cool. But
it's hard to know, though. And, you know, so I give Google a pass for that very reason, that I feel like that at some point Larry and Sergey really said what we just said, which is we want to celebrate actual invention and innovation and try to change the world versus just trying to make money and bamboozling people into giving us money so we can make money. And I give them a free pass in many respects. But then there's also this long lingering issue of, but are they still true to that vision? And were they ever? And maybe they really pulled the ultimate con. And so, you know what I'm saying? I feel like I'll give you an example, virtual reality. I'm always trying to decide, is this genuinely going to change things, or is this a repackaging of something we've had for 20 years that is no better than 3D movies? I mean, that's a tough thing to do.
Right. And I don't know either. I'm torn on VR. Like, I know Robert Scoble's all into it now, and Shell Israel and other people
that
are writing about it.
That, to me, is a warning sign. I love Robert, but he's an enthusiast, right?
Right, and he had Google Glass.
Yeah, enthusiasts, you got to worry about enthusiasts.
Yeah, and, Yeah, no, I
they get bamboozled before anybody else does.
Fucking sign. Yeah, it's like Scoble's into it. Okay.
Uh-oh.
But I see these people walking around with these sitting around with goggles on. I don't know, but then I see my kids staring into their screens. I'm being like,
yeah.
I think my son, if you gave him a pair of VR goggles, would never see him again.
He
would just be staying there. So maybe it is very compelling. I don't know I don't feel so confident about it for myself. But
I think our job, especially as more senior members of the tech press, because we've seen it, right? We've seen the cons. We've seen genuine revolution over the last few decades. We better than anybody have the context to understand what's going on. And I think we need to apply our skills and our insight to try to help people pick the good and winnow out the BS. And but that's what's great about your book. There is a manual for a BS detection. I am blown away by how much crap you got. What is it? The CEO sitting with a teddy bear next to him at meetings.
Yeah, the CTO brought a teddy bear, and even in their little response to the book, they said, you know, we're going to change X, Y, and Z. But on the teddy bear thing, yes, it's true, we do have a teddy bear, but you know, we're doubling down on the teddy bear. We're gonna keep, like the teddy bear. Yeah,
you can't
calling
make
a friend.
This crap up.
No, I remember sitting there going, like, I have fallen. I mean, think about, you know.
Am I in Wonderland?
Yeah, no, and think about, of all people, like, I wrote the fake Steve blog, and it's like, I've fallen into, this is like Alice in Wonderland, right? I've fallen into crazy land. This is great. This is unbelievable. It's like a treasure trove. And better than the teddy bear is that nobody laughed at the teddy bear. Like, nobody internally, you know, I could almost see working at a place where the boss is kind of kooky or goofy, but everybody would be doing impersonations of him behind his back, right? But this place, I would go around like asking people about the teddy bear, like, that's crazy, right? And they'd be like, no, I think the teddy bear is, you know, that's awesome. I think that the teddy bear is a really good idea. I'm like, no, come on, it's crazy. And they were like, no, it's the teddy bear is cool. And and they would say 1 + 1 = 3, and they had this made-up word, delightion, that meant the process of delighting customers, that we're in the business of delightion.
The jargon is very interesting, because I think that is a sign of – it happens all over tech, jargon and acronyms. But I think it becomes cultish if taken to an extreme, right? It's a way of defining the in-crowd – And it's establishing the other, and we're not the other, we're the in crowd. And that becomes very cultish. And I think that's done intentionally, again, by some very cynical managers who want to create that to manipulate the people in the bubble.
And if you look at cults, that is one of the first things they do is, they call it shifting language or shifting the language, where you in Scientology they do this, but you create this whole language that only you guys understand for exactly the reason you say. So that now the way to demonstrate how, in our case, HubSpotty, you would be at HubSpot was, how well do you know the lingo? How well can you talk that language, right? And can you use it without irony? Can you use it smoothly? And you buy into it. And it's also a way, language, I think, is so connected to thought that controlling how people speak and the words they use also ends up controlling how they think. And it makes it more difficult for them to think critically about the situation they're in.
Yeah.
So, yeah, all cults end up using or creating a shifted language.
Your friend says any place where the founder brings a teddy bear to meetings is a step away from Jonestown.
Yeah, there's Molly the teddy bear. Exactly.
You say mocking Dharmesh's teddy bear would be akin to a Scientologist making fun of L. Ron Hubbard's kooky captain's hat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know.
You don't mock the hat.
Don't make fun of the hat. L. Ron Hubbard, he was a great guy. I think they call him LRH, right? They use
LRH.
LRH, by the way, which is an amazing book, the Lawrence Wright book about,
isn't it good?
About Scientology.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was reading it as I was working at this place, and I remember thinking, like, oh my God, this is like so crazy. But I called a friend of mine after this, because another journalist who had gone into marketing, and but at a more of a mainstream place, and I called him up and I was like, hey dude, you know, I told him about the teddy bear, and I was like, is this I know, I realized this was going to be some adjustment going from journalism to this, but is this what it's like? And he's like, no, nobody has teddy bears. Like, no, that's crazy. You got to, get out of there. Run right now. And yeah, he's the guy who comes to step away from Jonestown, right? He's like, that's a cult, dude. That's not a company. And
we do. But, one does not mock the deer leader's head haircut.
Yeah, right. You don't mock.
That's a good haircut. Oh, nothing wrong with that.
Like in North Korea.
Yeah.
Nice looking haircut.
Nice haircut.
I want to get that.
That's
haircut.
An example of somebody nobody has ever said no to is Kim Jong-un's haircut. And you look at that as if you're a normal person, you look at that and go, who thought that was a good idea?
Oh, look at that. I think, it kind of works.
Who thinks that's a good idea? But no one will say to him, the shaving the side, maybe you should stop doing that.
Well, what do you think would look good on him, though?
I don't know, but why make your hair look like a wig, a bad wig? I don't.
Yeah, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, don't mock him.
Oh.
You know what?
Heaven forfend. That's the ultimate cult.
The one there, that one.
Look at that one.
That's a nice cut.
That's serious.
That's like. I don't even know what. Oh, that one I actually kind of like almost.
Well, he's got the little fork.
Yeah, he's got some bangs.
Yeah, bangs.
Doesn't look happy there. Here he does. He looks pensive.
All right, we're going to stop mocking the fearless leader because I'm afraid a nuke is going to destroy the studio.
Exactly. Suddenly your internet goes out.
That's why it's hard to laugh, but one has to laugh. One has to puncture this stuff. At the same time as one takes it seriously, it's important that one also laugh. Otherwise, we would all be crying. I had so many good laughs as I have over the years at Dan Lyons, the fake Steve Jobs, the real Dan Lyons, and the new book Disrupted. I want to talk about Silicon Valley when we come back. We got one more segment. If you've got the time, Dan, I realize I've manipulated.
I do. Yeah,
I'm monopolizing it. I think Dan is just. I'm telling you, you're the greatest, and I want to do more with you. So we're gonna.
Are you going to read an ad now, or what are you?
Yeah,
do
I'm going to read an ad.
Oh, okay.
Do you want to go to the bathroom? You can.
Yeah, I'm going to take a bathroom break.
Okay. Say hi to your wife. Apologize, if you will.
I'm going to tell her stay the hell out of my office. I'm working.
This is work.
This is. My
I know
job.
I'm wearing a toaster on my forehead and waving my arms, but I'm working. Damn it.
No, I don't want dinner.
Okay, Dan Lyons is our guest. Our show today brought to you by... So I said there are technologies that are important, that are not BS, that are changing the world. I want you to write the next great thing. I want you to create the next great site. And one tool that is so awesome that will help you do this is DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean is... There's a reason. It's the fastest growing cloud infrastructure provider. I almost hate using that phrase because that sounds like gobbledygook by itself. But they literally are growing like leaps and bounds because they're so great. So here's the thing: you're learning code, you're learning to write websites, or you want to create a website so you can mess with it, or you need a server, right? In the old days, we'd go to a company, we'd get a server, and you'd say, okay. They say, well, what operating system? Okay, well, we'll provision that. We'll get back to you in 48 hours. Watch this. This is what you want. First of all, it's very affordable, cheap. You sign up, create an account on DigitalOcean. I'm going to show you how you can use it for free, too, by the way. And now let's create a droplet. That's what they call it. But what we're going to do is provision an SSD server. SSD is important. That makes it super fast. First, if we want, we can choose our operating system, Ubuntu, FreeBSD, Fedora, Debian, CoreOS, CentOS. Or, and I love this, let's do a one-click app. Do you want to learn how to use Ruby on Rails or Mongo? Do you want to create a Redis site? Do you want to create a WordPress site? Are you learning Python and you want to learn the Django framework? Maybe you just want to create a container. Here's Docker. So I'm going to say, yeah, I want to create a Docker. I'm going to choose my size. Look, it's as little as $5 a month or, get this, 0.7 cents an hour, which is awesome. And that's a decent server. You can start. It's easy to increase the size and capacity of your server without creating a new server, by the way. So start with the lowest, absolutely. Pick the nearest data center. You see they're all over the world. I'm going to pick the one closest to us. Lots of additional things like automatic backups, IPv6, private networking. I always add my SSH key to it because that way I can log in. You get a root account and a shell and everything. You can have a fancy host name, but watch. I'm going to say create now. Watch this. This is kind of amazing. It is now provisioning a new server for me with its a unique IP address. I can have a shell login. It's running Debian or what is Ubuntu. And this is amazing. It is in under a minute provisioning a brand new server I can use right now. I think you could think of a lot of ways to use this. Over 600,000 developers have discovered DigitalOcean, including Father Robert uses it, Randall Schwartz uses it, Ann Newcomb uses it, I use it. Deploy and configure droplets quickly and easily, just like I just did with a simple API. You could do it as well. You don't have to go to the website. You can literally deploy it with your code. There, it's done. That's it. I am now running Docker at this address. I can log in with a shell and everything. It's amazing. This is incredible. Floating IPs for high availability, private networking, automated deployments, as I mentioned, via API. There's a great community. In fact, there is a page. I love it. There's a tutorial for any way you could think of to use your droplet. You want to set up a mail server? There's a page that says how to do it. So this is a great way to, if you're starting to learn this stuff, do it. And, of course, if you're an accomplished developer, if you've been working on this kind of thing, you'll see immediately the value of this. Deploy a cloud server in a minute. Starting at $5 a month, there's hourly pricing. It starts at 0.7 cents an hour. 0.7. It's less than a penny. DigitalOcean.com. Here's the deal. If you sign up for an account right now, you'll have to confirm it. Then go to the billing section, and there's a space for a promo code. Use triangulation as the promo code, and you're going to get a $10 credit. That's effectively 2 months free or more, really. It depends how you set it up. This, I am blown away by this. Talk about empowering technology. An individual can set up, create a new product, deploy it all. This used to be so hard. Maybe that's the difference. For me, this is a mind-boggling invention. You know, I remember how it used to be. DigitalOcean.com. Use the offer code triangulation and get a $10 credit, which is enough for a couple of months. DigitalOcean. Love these guys. Dan Lyons is our guest. His book... He's got many. He's the fake Steve Jobs. Go read those if you haven't read them. They're hysterical. And I think enough time has passed. Look, Dan, you loved Steve Jobs, right? You weren't...
I did. Yeah. I had a chance to meet him once, but I chickened out. He didn't want to meet me. It was at the iPad introduction. And some Apple guy said, come on up. I'll take a quick picture of you. Just jump in next to him.
I would have chickened out too, actually.
Yeah, dude. I don't know. You would have. Did you ever meet him in person?
Oh, yeah. I spent a weekend with him. So Will Hurst is a friend. And he I don't know if he still does this, but he used to do weekends, and he'd bring all these people. So it was Jerry Harrison of The Talking Dead and Steve Jobs and the guy who was MIPS, the founder of MIPS, chip engineer, a few other people. And I don't know how, but somehow my wife and I and our baby, because Abby was a couple of years old, got invited, spent a 4th of July weekend with him. And I talked to Steve, but Steve... It was interesting. This was his next period, right?
He
couldn't stop talking about Apple. It was really interesting. But he also, it was really clear that he knew he was the smartest guy in the room. And he was talking to the MIPS guy. He kind of wouldn't really talk to me. I talked to Lorraine, his wife. We had wonderful conversations. I read to his kids. We played volleyball together. So I feel like I had a social experience with him. But he was definitely arm's length because he knew I was a journalist. And I think he didn't also respect me. It was like, I don't know if you're smart or not. So you're going to have to prove yourself to me. So there was a certain truth to that kind of air that he had around him. But but like you, huge respect and frankly love and affection for the guy. You know.
And I've heard... that that Lorraine is an amazing.
She's wonderful. I really liked her. Yeah, she's very genuine and open, and she's doing, I think, going to do good things with his estate. Already is doing good things with his estate.
Really?
Yeah, I think the money is in good hands. Mm-hmm. Well, they finished the yacht, okay, but they'll do a few other things too.
Yeah, but
and Reed, his son, I read to Reed for a while. He was my daughter's age, so now he's. In his 20s. This was in 96. So
was he sort of in his early 20s now?
Yeah, he's in his early 20s, yeah.
Okay.
So Silicon Valley, by the way, I don't know how much of a hand you had. You joined in season 2.
Yeah.
You worked on 2 and 3. You're not there. You're not going to be there for season 4.
Right.
I'm sorry.
I know, me too.
But I think that's Hollywood, right? They want fresh ideas, fresh voices.
Yeah, they just want the pretty young things, these fresh new faces. Yeah.
You know, so I'm 59. You're a little younger. One of the ways I handle 37, and I tell you, you look great too. Yeah,
I do, don't I? Yeah.
One of the ways I've handled aging in this business is by creating my own business. Right? I can't. I can't be fired. and not everybody can do that, obviously. And it's a shame because I think people with a little gray hair have a unique perspective, as I mentioned, a context that the kids in this book lack clearly.
Well, yeah, maybe. I agree. But I think I more and more I've heard, you know, first of all, since the book came out, I'm getting email and tweets and LinkedIn messages every day at Facebook from people who read the book and tell me their story. And a lot of people have had similar experiences, which is kind of cool. I mean, also kind of sad, right, that so many people can relate to a book about something so unpleasant. But I have heard over and over that the way out is to start your own thing. I think that's true. I think that's probably
not everybody can do that. I'm making it my mission to hire everybody in their 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're gonna make
it's gonna be a lot of people to hire. It's gonna be a lot of people lining up, especially if this goes viral and they all find out. I think it's just
I'll tell you my fear. Is that the and I don't, you know what, this is normal, this is what happens, the new generation, they get to make it their own, right? We're gonna slowly get pushed out, and so I feel we have something to offer, but I understand, you know, if you're in your 20s, you think you're the smartest. What was it, there was a great quote, I heard you say this on Fresh Air. Mark Zuckerberg said that 20 people in their 20s are just smarter.
Young people are just smarter.
We're just smarter.
That's his famous quote.
And I think that's it's not true, but because we thought we were smarter too. but that's appropriate.
Yeah, I remember being impatient like that at 25 and thinking like, I wish these people would just get out of my way, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's a normal way to
give us time.
We will, yeah.
We'll be getting out of your way.
I'd be happy to right now, but...
But I'm not gonna. I think we need to go kicking and screaming because I think we have something to offer. And I think at Silicon Valley, now I'm fantasizing. I was thrilled when they hired you, and I'm fantasizing at this point. All the verisimilitude in this great show, and there is so much inside great stuff, is coming from Dan Lyons because everybody else, they're Hollywood kids, they're writing, they don't know from Silicon Valley. Is that true? You were
Sadly, no.
Did they really know this, what they're writing about?
You'd be shocked. I mean, the guy, yes, in a word. So Alec Berg, who's the showrunner, like the head writer, Mike Judge's partner.
Is Berg the creator?
No, Mike Judge created the show with two other guys.
Okay.
Those two other guys left and HBO put Alec Berg in there.
Got it.
Alec Berg was on Curb Your Enthusiasm with Larry.
Berg's great. Yeah.
Larry David. Yeah.
Right.
Alec Berg is great, and he's first of all really, really, really smart. His brother worked at Microsoft. His brother's a techie, and he went to college with Sheryl Sandberg and Mark Bodnick, and he knows a lot of people in Silicon Valley, and he knows that business frighteningly well. And every year, he takes the entire staff on a field trip to Silicon Valley, and they meet. We spent like a whole week basically just meeting, going one company to another, either VC firms or Google and Facebook or little startups or Dropbox, and just talking to people and just hearing stories and getting all this material out of people. We did do one roundtable with a bunch of journalists, tech journalists, and Ohm was one of them. Brian Lamb was another, guy from...
All right.
Yeah. And they do a lot of research and they spend a lot of time reading tech blogs. So even last summer in fall when I was working there, they were, you know, they have a Slack group set up, and basically there's people reading Business Insider and reading tech blogs constantly, Gizmodo, and then sharing stuff on there and going like, this is kind of funny or whatever. So no, you'd be surprised at how well versed they are. Now they're not people who covered it as journalists, right? But they have made a study of Silicon Valley in a way, and
I guess in a way, it's kind of awful. It's also that Silicon Valley is now more mainstream. I mean, it's not as it used to be, a real, you know, kind of off in the corner thing. The technology is now very mainstream, right? So yeah, why wouldn't they know about it?
No, I know. And they also have a tech consultant. The first year they had a guy, and then he brought in, this past year, he brought in two guys who had both had run a startup in and sold it to, I forget if it was Yahoo, but anyway, had built a company and sold it and was sort of like kicking around looking for what they're going to do next. And between now and then decided they would come in every day. So they have two, you know, techies, like real startup founders sitting in the room all day long, and then Dick Costolo as well. So there are a lot of people in their
former
room.
CEO of Twitter. He's been there, and he was an improv comic for a while too. So,
and so he thinks on his feet. He kind of knows what's funny. Yeah. And he, the first day he showed up, I came in and I sat down. There was one seat left, so I sat down and I realized, oh, that's Dick Costolo here. And I was like, oh, hey, I'd never met him before. And then at lunchtime, he got lunch, and I said, oh, are you sticking around for the full day? He said, no, I'm working here now. And I was like,
wow.
Oh, that's weird. Okay.
It is weird.
but so they have a lot of people who really know. And Alec Berg's big thing is that they don't really need to mix up. If they just told real stories, the show would be funny enough.
Oh, right? Absolutely.
Which is kind of true. And he loves the idea of capturing that verisimilitude. And then, of course, exaggerating it and bending it.
Do they write an outline and then add elements into it to, like, you know, there's an Oculus Rift and, you know, they add these little elements to give it that verisimilitude, or is it part of the whole process?
You basically sit in a room, 10 or 12 of you, however many there are, and you talk and talk and talk and talk about episode 3, say.
Right.
And you know it begins here and it's going to end there, and you're trying to fill in the middle. And you need a storyline for every character, right? So Ehrlich needs a storyline.
Right.
Dinesh and Guilfoyle need storylines. Jared needs a storyline. And you want them to intersect. Sometimes they can go off on a tangent. But basically, you're blocking it out that way. And at some point, after some number of days, whatever, Alec Berg will be like, and we have it all up on whiteboards, Alec will say, okay, I have enough here. I'm just going to go sit in a room and write the outline. And he'll go by himself for 2 or 3 days and come back with a very, very detailed outline that's not in script format, but in just regular prose. And they'll go over that. We'll all go over that together and make suggestions, punch in jokes. Maybe this doesn't work. And we'll do that process a few times until finally it gets to the point where they can actually write a script based on the outline. But they start with a very, very, very detailed outline that Alec writes. So,
and then the script is assigned to a different writer each time. It's kind of rotates.
Yeah,
through.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
You really were an equal. You didn't have a separate role in there. You were one of the writers in the writer's room.
Yes, but there's a ranking system, and which I wasn't aware of in Hollywood. And it's a very hierarchical system. So I was my first year there as a staff writer, which sounded really cool to me, except that really means peon, right? Like staff writer means like you're one level above the assistant who gets the lunch. Literally, I mean, you're in terms of the rank,
right?
Because it's unionized, right?
Are you supposed to shut up?
Yeah, yeah, a lot. Like when I first started, I visited a friend of mine who is a showrunner, so he's like an executive
producer.
That's the
highest level. Yeah,
yeah. And he said to me, "Come visit my show before you go there, and just meet all my writers. You can see what a writing room looks like. So you won't be completely cold when you go in there." I said, "Okay, fine." And then he said to me, "Look, you don't have to talk." He said, "The two mistakes people make is you talk too much or you talk too little." And he said, "And I said, well, how much is you know what?" He said, "Look, at your level, if you don't talk for the first 2 weeks, if you don't say a word for 2 weeks, that's perfectly okay." And I was like, "Oh, okay, great." So,
we're showing the end of season one.
Oh, right.
Where is it? Jared gets stuck in a self-driving vehicle and put in a container on a ship.
yeah, sorry, shipped out to
the secret island. Peter Thiel's
car.
Peter Thiel's secret island.
yeah. Oh, here he's going into the container. So. I was a staff writer, and then the next year I got a little promotion to co-producer, which sounds really cool, but it's actually also a fairly low rank.
Yeah, I noticed your name is the last name in the credits.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Those bastards. So there's a real hierarchy.
I mean, co-producer sounds really good.
It sounds great, but there is nothing below it now, you know. I mean, so you're very aware of that the co-EPs, the co-executive producers, have all the they're the big guys, so they can talk a lot. The next level down are kind of like the, what do they call them? I guess producers or there's another, there's about a dozen of these little ranks on the ladder. And yeah, and people are very much aware of where they are in the pecking order and who gets to talk the most. So yeah, at my level, I was mostly an add-on.
So you would throw in at a joke every once in a while, something like that, or?
Or yeah, on the jokes, I mean, they're really funny people, and like I would more stick to like plot points or character stuff, or here's what would happen now. I think the new CEO would be thinking X, Y, and Z right now, or there's a real story from tech where, remember the story where the guy from Adobe got kidnapped?
Yes.
Back in the early 90s, Chuck Geschke.
Yeah.
And I was always thinking like there should be a runner where somebody gets kidnapped. But and it would be based on true story. So stuff like that. I mean, that never made it into the show. But yeah. So I would try to kick in when I could. But it's a very collaborative process, and some collaborators are more equal than others.
Perfect description. So,
yeah.
The show, it must have been fun to work on it because it really is, I think, very well done. Although I heard a couple of people after this last week's episode, not one that was on yesterday, but the week before, where the new CEO of the company makes some massive changes. And some people said that was too real. That was painful. I've been through that. And I can't watch it. It's like, I get that feeling again when they decide, hey, you know, we're not going to be a consumer play. We're going to go to B2B. And you got to, you know what, that thing that you were doing that we were so excited about, forget that. That's not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was
painful.
And I think they liked that. I think Mike Judge likes that kind of humor that's
too close to the bone.
It makes you uncomfortable. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's funny, but it also is like, you know, kind of makes you a little uneasy. I think that's kind of Mike's sensibility is that kind of. Well, no, Alex too, because I mean, you think of Curb. Curb has all those moments. Where
painful.
It's like a little bit like
awkward moments.
Like you want the scene to end, but it won't end. And so I think they both kind of like that uncomfortable humor. So it's not. Some of it is rat-a-tat, kind of bang bang, you know, like, you know, set up punchline, but a lot of it is situational. It's just awkward and weird, and a lot of that is driven by the actors because they're very, really good and they're all improv guys.
Oh, so there's a lot of improv going on.
Yeah, I think so.
Tobolowsky's incredible. I just, as a CEO, he's schlumpy and vapid. And it's perfect.
although, you know, it could have been cast another way. It could have been cast as sort of like Scott McNeely.
Right.
Right? It could have been that kind of guy.
Right.
You could have cast like the alpha male CEO guy who is plays hockey and golf and blah, blah, blah. You know, or, I mean, there's lots of that's what I think is sort of brilliant about it, and the part that I still don't understand, and because it's, you know, Alec and Mike and those guys have just – they've done so much TV and film that – they've forgotten more than I'll ever know.
Right.
But like that essence, I think Mike is really the big guy on casting. Like, how do you see in your mind's eye what that character? Because think about the character of Action Jack Barker. Until he's cast, is just something on paper, right?
Right.
It's just, and everybody has a different picture in their head of what he looks like. And if you cast Tobolowsky, it's one thing. If you cast, I don't know, the guy who played Russ Hanneman last year, you know, the venture capitalist guy, you know, they becomes a very different character. So Mike Judge, I think, is part of his genius is he can see through the paper into what it's going to look like when it's actually acted out, or what it's going to sound like when it's read. You know, he's really really good at that.
Did you get to spend much time on the set, or are you stuck in the writer's room?
Well, the first year, the writing season ended before production. So a bunch of us all left before production began. This past year, I stayed for the beginning of production. And then a few writers stayed all the way through production into the winter. But I didn't. I went home about Halloween.
Yeah.
So the end of October, they had just started production. So I started a few days of shooting.
That's a whole different part of the process. It's a very different part from the writing of the...
I think you know more about it than I do. I mean, because I think that's true. But I, you know, it's in the building next. The building where we wrote was one building, and then The soundstage was next door. But yeah, I mean, that's just long days of shooting and doing retakes and different angles. I found that fascinating that they would shoot the same scene and they needed coverage from a whole bunch of different angles. Yeah. So they would just reblock it and put the, I mean, keep the actors the same, but move the cameras and shoot now. Let's get a take with from Ehrlich from the side, you know, that kind of stuff.
They got real patience. I couldn't do that. I'd just go crazy doing that over and over.
Yeah, you have to be a certain, I think, yeah, and the director is the one sitting there, and the director is kind of, I think, again, in his mind or her mind, like they, maybe they don't even know what they're going to edit together, how that scene is going to run, but they want to have coverage from a bunch of different cameras. And then it's almost like making a painting, right? You're taking all this visual imagery and putting it together to make the scene work. And yeah, that's a phenomenal kind of a painstaking process that I'm still not very familiar with.
When are you writing the book on this one?
Writing a book about...
Silicon Valley, working at Silicon Valley.
Oh, never, dude, never. No,
no revelations?
No, it's not that, you know, it's not that interesting. I mean, I don't think, I mean, you sit in a room with a bunch of people and they're really funny and they tell stories, but...
I hear the food is very good in the writer's room.
Is that what you heard, really?
Yeah, not so.
Well, they send out for lunch every day. So you get a nice lunch every day brought in. That's nice. And then on set, it's kind of like, you know, craft services food.
Right.
And, you know, you go down the buffet line. The thing I was struck by was how not glamorous almost every aspect of it is, except for when they have the premiere and there's a red carpet and they all come out.
Did you go to the premiere in the Silicon Valley?
Not this year. Last year I did.
Yeah.
But in L.A. they did one. But, yeah, I was struck by, like, you know, seeing all these actors who to me are very glamorous people. Right. And then you see them when they're working and it's kind of like when they're not on a shot, they're sitting on like these folding chairs in a warehouse.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like it's kind of boring and they're reading a book and then they're eating this kind of crappy food. And it's a long day in a big room with no windows in it, you know. Yeah. And I was like, oh, it's not really.
That's so much
fun. That was one thing that struck me is how many people there are who aren't actors or anything. They're just, you know, the crew, right? And the crew are just regular folks doing their thing. And yeah, that part of it was interesting to me.
Don't ruin the glitter, the stardust for me. I don't want to know.
The magic. The magic. Well, it was really fun for me. This past year, I got to walk around on the sets and a couple of us went in and we took pictures of each other hanging out on the sets and stuff. And it was really cool because they do look like real rooms. That part was really neat.
Yeah.
But,
Well, I just love your writing. What do you think's ahead for you? Are you what do you want to do? Are you going to go back to writing books, or
I'm thinking more content marketing. I'm going to go to HubSpot's direct competitor. I'm going into Pardot as a blogger, content blogger. No, I don't know. I think I want to write another book because I like writing books, maybe do some journalism.
Oh, wow. There's a thought.
Yeah, that could be good again,
right? This book is amazing, is funny, and this is, as you can probably tell, a very funny guy, but there is a lot in here that I think is fascinating and eye-opening. And just as the TV show is with humor really telling the truth about an industry that can deserve some puncturing, even better. Disrupted. And by the way, all the people in here, Nick Bilton, all your log rolling, Ashley Vance, Brad Stone, good people, good people. Dan Lyons has...
A log rolling.
It's called log rolling, right?
You see right through me.
I see it all.
Yeah, no, you're right. Those are really good guys, and they were very kind to do that. Yeah.
The book, My Misadventure in the Startup Bubble, it's on Audible. Yes, you can listen.
I did the audiobook myself.
You can hear Dan's...
With my Boston accent.
His Merrimack Valley accent coming through there. I love it. Don't change. Don't ever change, Dan.
No.
And there you go. And also, of course, you can buy it at bookstores. And everybody should buy it. It's a really good book. And I am thrilled to get you on finally. And please come back. And we'd like this to be a regular stop for you.
Oh, me too. Thank you so much for having me.
Dan Lyons, in the website, realdanlyons.com.
Soon to be updated with a new cover art, new homepage. Yeah, I'm going to get rid of that. That was in Iceland, that picture.
It doesn't matter. It's timeless. It's placeless.
Timeless, yeah. It looks like I'm about to get killed by a car.
No, actually, it looks like you're showing your muscles and pulling a giant Ford F-150 truck. Dan Lyons.
Yeah, I think I need a new mania. We'll work on it. Anyway,
Dan,
thank you.
So good to talk to you. Come back soon.
Same here.
Thank you, Dan. Our show, we do this show, and every time I say, you got to see this show every week. It's always something interesting. Tune in 11 a.m. Pacific, which would be 2 p.m. Eastern time, 1800 UTC. If you want to watch live on Mondays, please do. We love having you in the chat room and all of that. But if you can't, we have on-demand audio and video of all of our shows. This one's at twit.tv/TRI, short for triangulation. But you can, and you know what? We're on Air Canada, so the next time you're stuck in a plane, you can watch us there. And we are also on every podcast platform. And there's Twit apps, too, and everything, Roku and Apple TV. There's 5 Twit apps on Apple TV. Pick one, and you'll never miss an episode. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.